talk about. I kind of wanted to reserve this when I suspected that it would be members, and so we're going to talk a little bit this morning about Christians and culture. This is a kind of a niche study that I started a few years ago, as I noticed that many Christians were coming to me and they were concerned about the cultural changes that they were seeing in our country that seemed to be happening rapidly and then exponentially, and all of the things that were going on. And so I noticed that a lot of Christians were asking me questions about that, and so I kind of dug into it and have given it a little bit of thought and have studied it to some degree, and I wanted to share that with you this morning, because I think it is I think it's helpful. I'll make this point a little bit more poignantly later on, but culture counts. You can't ignore the culture around you. I kind of learned that the hard way deployed to the Middle East. I went in and looked at the world through the lens of an American, and you can't get anything done like that if you're someplace else. It's fine in America. You can't do that if you're in Afghanistan or Iraq or in Yemen or someplace like that. And so you've got culture. Culture has an impact on people. Culture has an impact on what's going on around us. We can't put our heads in the sand and think that as our culture changes, there are not certain effects that's going to have on us, and then ask those questions, kind of get ahead of it. I cite John chapter 13, verse 34 and 35. We read that on Thursday night. This is the passage where Jesus, as he is talking to his apostles on the night of his arrest, says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you will love one another just as I have loved you. You also are to love one another. By this all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." And I wanted to revisit that, because I think ultimately that has to be in the back of our mind as we deal with the changes in culture and our efforts to take the gospel to people, and in our efforts to live as disciples. Is that, as we talked about on Thursday night, our motivation has to be love for God and love for one another. I'm going to tell you something from experience. You can't convince anybody to come to Christ if you're so mad that your jaws are clenched and they're spit flying. You know, you're not going to convince somebody that they don't care about your arguments about baptism's necessity to salvation if you're so mad the veins are sticking out from your forehead. And that's not accusing any of you. That's a reflection. That's a reflection of me. I've always kind of dealt with, you know, I've got one of those personalities. So anyway, this morning we're gonna talk a little bit and think about this idea of culture and how it is changing. I'm a guy who generally subscribes to the tragic worldview. That is, I think the world is a broken place. I don't think you're ever going to get a utopian experience here, no matter what political system you set up. I'm an advocate of what Winston Churchill said about our system. He said it's the worst system there is, except all of the others. And I kind of advocate for that. I think we've got a great system. I think it is brilliant, but it's also imperfect. I mean, that's just the fact. We live in a world that is broken, and there's only so much we're going to be able to do about it to kind of function and to get through. There are highs and lows. We talked about this on Friday night. There's the same thing that we see in history. We see these cycles in history where maybe at least regionally or nationally, things are kind of going smooth, and then we're going to go in cycles. And I will tell you, we're just in one of those cycles right now. I believe people are all the time talking about it's never been worse than it is right now. You know, the historian in me tells you, until we kill 750,000 Americans, it's not as bad as it has ever been. As a matter of fact, you can even compare it. There are a lot of parallels to what's going on in our country right now to what was happening in the 60s and the early 70s and then in the few years after that. There are many parallels to that. Again, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does. Mark Twain made the point, it rhymes. And so I think a reflection on those things might help Christians recognize some pitfalls and some mistakes that we can make and some things that we can change. we need to recognize that human history has changed over time. You know, we went from being hunter-gatherers, we went to an agrarian culture, we went from agrarian to an industrial culture, we've gone from an industrial world into a digital age or an information age. They haven't even settled on what they're going to call it yet, but we're there. And with that comes upheavals. There are some problems that come from those. Real quick, let me share one with you. If you were to go back 100 years, back to the early part of the 20th century, and look at what precipitated the 18th Amendment with Prohibition. And so many workers, the industrial age rises, a nation that's about 85% small farms, young men and fathers move to town for better jobs in factories and so on. And the result of that in many places was, particularly in the eastern United States, was the breakdown of the family. Dad's never there, dad's gone, and dad's lonely to be at home. He's working all day long, and many of them turned to alcohol. There was an enormous problem of alcohol in major American cities in the east, and the wives rose up against that. And it was wives who pushed temperance. Historians have gone back, there were no polls at the time, historians have gone back because we amended the Constitution of the United States to make alcohol illegal. And historians, because there were no polls, have gone back and kind of tried to figure out, okay, what does it take in popular sentiment to be able to even amend a constitution, the Constitution of the United States? And they've kind of settled somewhere between about 70 and 85% popular. So that was the popular sentiment. We look back at it kind of now as kind of being naive, you know, you're trying to prohibit something like that. But what that tells us is that our population, our country, was in a cultural upheaval. Things were changing faster than they could metabolize it and deal with it. And it created enormous social problems to the point that the country basically said, we've got to do something. And having been on the receiving end of people saying, we've got to do something, I'm not crazy about that. So let's think a little bit about what we can help during these transitions. I want you to think about a founding virtue in our country that was known as virtue. And so if you go back and you read not only our founders' writings, but there are also two political observers that are important to American history. They're an Englishman and a Frenchman, Francis Grund, who visited the United States in the 1820s, and then a guy you probably have heard of, wrote a book called Democracy in America, Alexis de Tocqueville. He came in the 1840s, and they were outsiders who came to the United States and said, we want to see what all the fuss is about. What makes this place different than Europe, or are they just an extension of European politics and so on? And so what they both found was there's something very different about the United States at that time, at least in its founding. And let me point out something. They agreed, it wasn't perfect. It was different in good ways, but it was still imperfect. It was incomplete. We didn't figure everything out in the founding age. And one thing I think Christians need to be careful about is having these nostalgic ideas about the past. I will pick on her a little bit because she's not here. My mother and dad were raised, they were kids in the 1950s and the early 1960s, and my mom spends a lot of time watching Gunsmoke and Andy Griffith, and that's good for her. I'm glad she likes that. But I'm going to tell you something, folks. Life wasn't perfect in real Mayberry. Anyway, life wasn't perfect in the 1950s. It had its problems. We had our challenges. There was still right and wrong, and the same thing of the founding period. But there was something that they noticed in their observations, that there were things that were worth considering. And what we have seen is that they broke it down into these four categories. They viewed what we can refer to as primary virtues. And what they said of America was, what they noticed was industriousness and honesty. In other words, work ethic. As a matter of fact, both of these observers said, if you leave an American alone long enough, I mean, their only striving is for industry. They want to make They want to build. They want to plant. They want to reap. They want to sow. To the point that they said, they describe them as materialistic. Now, whether they're materialistic or not, it might have been some other drive, but what they noticed was they work, and they're good at it, they're industrious, they're creative in that. The second thing was honesty. Now, does that mean there was not a crime rate? Nope, it doesn't mean there wasn't a crime rate, but there does seem to be a significant common thread that ran through American life at that time, that people were fair, they were honest. Yes, there was still a criminal element. There's always a criminal element. And then they observed that there were two nurturing institutions who kind of supported all of that. And there were marriage and religion. We talked about that a little bit last night. When anthropologists have found cultures that have been isolated from the rest of the world, they find very commonly that they have some system of religion and they also rely on the family. And so basically what these political observers, Grandin de Tocqueville, noticed is that because of marriage and religion, because of home and church, those were the institutions that nurtured those primary virtues of industriousness and honesty. As a matter of fact, our founders recognized that you can't have the kind of liberty that they were trying to give, that they were trying to protect in our Constitution, you can't have that if you don't have religion. If you don't have morals based on religion, you're not going to be able to have it. And so their idea was, if America is virtuous, the government can back off. The government can step back. There doesn't have to be intrusive laws. There doesn't have to be draconian laws, because people are going to act the way they're supposed to act. Why? Because, look, until recent American history, 80% of Americans were in church on every Sunday. Now, we can have all the doctrinal arguments we want to between various religious institutions, but we do have to admit this. Regardless of those doctrinal things, the cultural significance that that percentage had on America was a positive one. When I grew up, whether a kid was going to a Baptist church, a Methodist church, a Lutheran church, or the Church of Christ, he learned right from wrong in a moral sense. He wasn't going to cheat. He wasn't going to lie. Some of them were. You know, some of them, you were no bringing them back. But generally speaking, people, that had an impact on people. And so we recognize that in the culture of our country in the past. Last year there was a poll that was done, and for the first time in American history, the number one religious group by percentage in the American population were what they now refer to as nones, N-O-N-E-S. For the very first time in American history, the largest religious group were, I don't do anything. I'm not necessarily an unbeliever, but I don't go to church. I'm not engaged in a church community. I don't participate in any kind of religious institutions. There's a new buzzword coming along that I'm spiritual but not religious. I think that's ridiculous. I don't get that. I think that's kind of making excuses to. but regardless. Now we are clearly in a different place. We've had some cultural change. There is a great argument that cultural change started in the early 1960s, and it just kind of the waves are not quite as big. In other words, we've been going through this with some minor changes since then, and I think that's a pretty fair argument. Although he gets a beating on campuses. If you ever get a chance, read Charles Murray's book, Coming Apart, and it talks about he's been characterized as a racist. He's not, at least in my estimation, but he does a great job showing, based on these virtues and these institutions, how the United States has changed in a relatively short period of time, 50 years. Now, that leaves us with a transition as disciples. Okay, what are we supposed to do? Because the culture changes, and the message certainly cannot. We'll come back to that in a minute. What are we supposed to do? And the reason I wanted to start with John 13, 34, and 35 is because that has to be the foundation of whatever it is we do. We have to love. We have to love the people that, we have to love our neighbors ourselves, be concerned, have concern for the souls that are lost and that are wrestling with this, and admit that we ourselves are wrestling with this. I'll be the first to admit there are days, you know, I joke with my dad, you know, I used to laugh at dad because he'd be standing there at news time. Back then it was just, you know, Walter Cronkite at six or 6:30, whenever it was. And he, you know, my dad would be pointing his finger and yelling at the TV. I used to laugh at that when I was a teenager. I thought, man, he's finally gone over the edge. Nope, I get it. In my 50s now, I get it, because I look back and I see a world that I loved, a society that I loved, a culture that I loved, that I grew up with, that I thought was pretty fair and equitable, being changing significantly and not for the better. It's not that I was naive. I knew there were things that we still needed to work on, but I am not up for tearing the system down and doing something else. And so we need to recognize this has an impact on disciples. And so let's think a little bit about what a disciple can do. Number one, we need to recognize culture counts. Our culture has changed. We talked a little bit about that earlier. We're not the same place that we were a few years ago. For all the changes that have taken place in the last 50 years, the last decade has been even more so. And I would encourage you, and I can give you the sources for this if you're interested in studying this. I hate to be one of those old middle-aged or past middle-aged guys that are all the time grousing about social media, but I'm going to tell you something. It's got something to do with what's going on in our country right now, particularly for teenage boys and girls, and girls get hit harder by it than boys. Boys have got their own set of problems, but girls are just getting beaten down because they've given into social media. Now, it's a little bit different for adults. By the time you're an adult, you ought to be able to see through all of the high school shenanigans, but for a 13, 14-year-old girl, social media is a hard thing to navigate. And now we are just to the point where our society, where our human minds, as flexible as we are, we have outstripped technologically our ability to adjust to it fast enough. And so we are kind of in a precarious place. And so culture counts. We need to admit that. We need to think about, okay, how does it affect us? And how should we respond to it, both in trying to figure it out for us and our children, our grandchildren, our families, our homes, our church, but also how does it affect how I would approach somebody, particularly younger people, who are now, this is their culture, how do we approach them in regard to evangelism? So culture counts. Extremes can misinform. So it is my, I will tell you, it is my, we were visiting the, I would call it a ham store yesterday. What town were we in?
Princeton, Newsom's.
Okay, Newsom's. If everybody knows where Newsom's is in Princeton, AJ and Randy took us in there, and let me tell you something. That ham, they gave us some samples. Man, I'll tell you, I'm still kind of in a salt coma from that, but it was delicious. Might not be good for you, but it was good. Randa hands me this card and says, here, take a look at it. That's you. And it was about this guy who, I can't remember the whole line, but it was about a guy who was up in the hills all by himself and there was no cell service. And that is me. I would be that guy that would be up for isolation, going to the mountain, living in my cabin until the Lord comes home and I'm not going to worry about it anymore. I am a guy suited to dropping out. But I can't. We can't isolate. The Lord said, go. The Lord said, make disciples of them. And we're going to talk about that culture in just a second. Neither can I assimilate. I can't just say, well, it's the world we live in, and you know, you got to go along to get along. Somewhere in the middle of all of that, we have to recognize that we have to be in the world, but we cannot be of the world. And that's an important distinction. And so, again, those extremes will get us in trouble. If we say, okay, I'm out, I don't want anything to do with this, I'm going to drop out and just wait for the end, we're not fulfilling the Great Commission. Secondly, if we assimilate and we give in, we're not fulfilling the directives that our Lord gave us about remaining, be holy for I am holy. And so we have to recognize that as well. So we're going to spend the balance of our time this morning talking about these applications that we can consider, and maybe will help guide us through this. So we need to learn to adjust the method without adjusting the message. It's not 1957 anymore, and you're not in Kansas anymore. It is a different world, and our techniques of evangelism have to change. My dad tells stories. My dad started preaching in the mid-60s. And my dad tells stories about being able to walk down the street in our hometown, and if you ask 10 people to have a Bible study, you'd probably get 6 or 7 takers.
Yeah.
And you'd be able to go into a diner, or you'd be able to go get together at the house on a Saturday evening and have a piece of pie and a cup of coffee and sit and talk about the Bible. I will tell you, that is not the case anymore. It's not that technique won't work anymore. That technique could get the cops called on you. That technique, and I'm not suggesting we should be afraid of it if it worked, but I will tell you, it just doesn't work anymore. So we've got to be willing to make some adjustments of, okay, what does work? And I want to go back to that point of John 13. Even Jesus made the point. Jesus didn't give us these great big evangelistic programs that we see so often in many churches. And I'm not against planning, and I'm not against organization. That's not my point. Jesus said, if you live, in effect, this is Jesus' message in John 13, 34, and 35. If you relate to one another the way I have related to you, if you love one another the way I have loved you, by this all will know that you are my disciples. Your greatest tool of evangelism is your relationship with one another and your love for one another and your love for others.
Amen.
Because there is that hole that is in every human heart that wants that. And if they see that in a genuine, authentic manner, then people are going to respond to that. Even people in a modern age where our culture is beginning to become less religious, more secular, less optimistic, more pessimistic. Even in that, there's one thing that people really want. People want love. I am the worst guy in the world to be talking about stuff like this because I am not a touchy-feely kind of dude. But I will tell you, and I'm not a Beatles fan, but hey, man, love really is the solution to this. And so we need to learn to begin to adjust that message without adjusting or adjust the technique without adjusting the message. Let me give you a quick example. The Apostle Paul. Paul was brilliant at this. Paul could walk into a Jewish synagogue, and the only thing that came off of his tongue was Jewish history and Jewish theology. That's it. But then consider Acts 17. He goes to Mars Hill to the Areopagus, and he is standing before Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. Not what you would say is, you know, we would not think of doing that today.
No.
We wouldn't think of going to Harvard to the philosophy department and say, let's talk. And quite honestly, I'd mess that up if we did. Paul didn't. Paul nailed it. Paul, not once did he mention Judaism or the Levitical law or anything of that nature. What did he appeal to? He appealed to philosophy, logic, reason, and nature. Why? Because that's the world they understood. Paul made the point, I can be all things to all men. Wasn't going to change the message, but Paul recognized, I can go into a group of blue-collar tent makers and I can make the case. Or I can go to Mars Hills amongst academics and I can make the case. Now look, all of us are not going to be able to do that. And I'm not holding all of us up. But what I am saying is, Paul recognized that you've got to adjust how you work, but you cannot change that message. You don't have a cookie-cutter template for evangelism. You can't be the bull in the china shop who only has one technique. You have to take a more indirect approach to people in this very thing. Okay. Turn over, if you would, to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Corinthians chapter 7, beginning in verse 17. begin reading there. Only let each person leave the life that the Lord has assigned to him and to which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches. Was anyone at the time of his call already circumcised? Let him not seek to remove marks of circumcision. Was anyone at the time of his call uncircumcised? Let him not seek circumcision. For neither circumcision counts for anything nor uncircumcision, but keep the commandments of God. Each one should remain in the condition in which he is called. Were you a bondservant when called? Do not be concerned about it. But if you gain your freedom, avail yourself of the opportunity. For he who has been called in the Lord as a bondservant is a freedman of the Lord. Likewise, he who was free when he is called a bondservant of Christ, you were bought with a price. Do not become bondservants of men. So brothers, in whatever condition each one was called, there let him remain with God. Those words, as wise as they are a bitter pill, would have been a bitter pill to swallow for somebody who was in bond service. And so one of the things that I think that we need to recognize is that Christianity is not and should not be used as a social movement.
Amen.
We've got to be careful where we weigh in on this social thing and that social thing and the other social thing. We've got to be cautious about this. In effect, Paul is saying, and Americans have got a weird view of this. I have noticed in my travels overseas that we've got a jaundiced view of this. I'm very thankful for the freedoms and the liberties that we have in this country. I really am. I've seen the alternatives, and they're not pretty. And so I'm thankful for what we have. But I will also tell you, it is possible to thrive as a child of God regardless of the political system in which you live. There were people behind the Iron Curtain who lived as faithful Christians. It's hard. It was challenging. It could be deadly, but they did it. There are people all over the world today. There are Christians in China, communist China today. There are Christians all over the Middle East in countries who live by Sharia law. It's illegal to do what they're doing. But they're doing it. And so we need to recognize, and I think that ultimately that's what Paul is saying here. Be very, I think we have to do some expectation management. We have to recognize there's only so much a political system is going to give me. I need to rely on God to navigate the hardships of life, whether that hardship is behind the Iron Curtain or something else. We're just lucky. We're blessed. Now, we shouldn't take that for granted. We need to wake up every day and be thankful. It's easier on us to fulfill what God has asked us to do because we have the freedoms and the liberties that we have. It's much more difficult in other places. Here's an interesting point too. If you go back and you look at that first century AD, I made this observation recently at home. There ought to be some comfort where we are in our culture right now because we can draw on something that earlier generations, I don't know, appreciated. If we were to go back in American history to the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, when it was a largely very religious place, that culture, that American, earlier American culture, was less like the first century culture in which Christianity begun than what we have today. We have a very similar situation to what the very first generation of Christians living in the time of Rome. And I'm not trying to compare America and Rome. That's not my point. But if we look at it culturally, 21st century America is more like the culture that Christianity began in than 1950 America was. And so when we go back and we look at the New Testament and say, okay, how did these Christians navigate their culture? That's a good exercise for us because we are in a culture very close to that, where it was predominantly secular. There was a government. Remember, Paul used his Roman citizenship to his advantage when he was arrested. And so there was a government system there that kind of protected those liberties. Christians, it was a while before Christians began to be persecuted by the Roman government. So again, it's not a social movement. We need to learn to function regardless of of where we are and what system we are under. Ephesians 4:15. Here's another thing that I think that all Christians need to work on. Paul makes the point that we are expected to speak the truth, but he said you can speak it in love. Speak the truth in love. I had to learn this as I grew older, but I hope I'm a little bit better at it now. But you know, you can begin to tell who's losing the debate if you're watching the debate. I have always had great admiration for the guy who could debate and never raise his voice. Just maintain his calm, and his point was, I have the facts. I have the data. I have the truth. And I don't have to be the loudest voice in the room. I can't help but be the loudest voice in the room. I don't have to be the guy who's foaming at the mouth and doing and making all the snarky comments. I don't have to do that. That's the person that I always had a great appreciation who could just maintain that even keel and debate right through it, and the other guy is just like a pit bull. Because the guy who is the pit bull is losing the debate and just doesn't know it. I have always imagined the Apostle Paul being the calm, cool, even-keeled guy who is just presenting the facts and saying, brethren, here's the way it is. And he's putting the pieces of the puzzle together. He's connecting the dots through Scripture. And he's saying, here it is. This is the way. What you're going to do with it, that's up to you. Paul made the point, speak the truth in love. You don't have to compromise the truth, but you don't have to be a pit bull either. And so we can learn what Paul learned. We have to be cautious about attitudes that are perceived or otherwise by those around us. I had a calm moment one time that made an impact on me that changed me. I had a discussion with a guy I served with. We were deployed, and I wasn't my old self. He caught me at a calm moment, and he started asking some questions, and we started talking about the Bible. And he was pretty upset. And I just kept thinking to myself, all right, stay calm, stay. And finally he came down. You know, he came down to my level, and we were both calm, and we had a great discussion. And when he left, he said, this is the first time that I've ever had a discussion with somebody that just didn't turn into a knockdown dragout about religion. He said, I appreciate that. That went, I'm not bragging on me, because that was a rarity for me at that time. But I will tell you, that went in my memory bank. What that told me was, fighting doesn't get you anywhere. Just debating, just trying to win the debate doesn't get you anywhere. We'll speak the truth in love. As a result of that, we think about all of these passages about love. We need to be cautious. And there are passages where we are told to be holy, for I am holy, God says. And in regard to the Pharisees, the holiness created in them another problem. And that problem was arrogance. And so we need to beware of that leaven of the Pharisees. Luke chapter 12 and verse 1 defines that for us. Jesus says, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. In other words, that word hypocrite is the Greek word through its etymology to English that gives us the word actor. They were play-acting at religion and at holiness. They were putting on their Sunday suit, their righteous suit, and saying, "Look how religious I am! Look how pious I am!" And there you go. But there was no depth to it. We need to be cautious that we don't make the same mistake. It is common for people who are very serious about their religion, about their doctrine, about their word, about their way. It is very common for them to, as they get good at it, as they become holy, as they become righteous, as they become what God asks us to do, they start looking down their nose at other people and saying, well, I did it. Why can't you? God doesn't want us to do that. God wants us to be holy and maintain our humility all at the same time and recognize I'm broken. I'm a sinner in recovery. I still have my days where I don't do what I know I'm supposed to do. But I keep coming back. God keeps taking me back to maintain humility before God. So I need to be cautious about that. Another mistake we can never make is to evangelize a church. That's not what we're about. It's not what we're trying to do. We're not trying to bring people to the church of Christ. That's not our responsibility. I said that one time in a congregation, man, and I'm not kidding you, it sucked the collective oxygen out of the room. People just thought I was a heretic. But they didn't, you know, they wouldn't, and then I lost them and I couldn't get around the main point. So I am not, we've got to be cautious about how we're evangelizing. What are we trying to do? We're trying to bring Christ, we're trying to bring people to Jesus. The people, his church, is a byproduct of that. It's a result of that. It's just a group of people. It's like a family. We're trying to bring people to the family. But the motivation for bringing people to the family is Jesus and his sacrifice. We've got to be very cautious about my church is the right church. My church is the good church. My church is the one, and you know where this goes. And, you know, if we were all being fair, we've probably all been a little bit guilty of this over the years. But we need to be very cautious that we don't make that mistake. Most secular-minded people in the world are rightly tired and disgusted with governing bodies of all types, whether religious or civil. They're done with that. They don't want somebody, they don't want to think that we're trying to bring them to an organization that is then going to ride herd over their life. They don't want that. But I tell you what they do want. They do want relationships. They are interested in relationships. The relationships that change their life. They are interested in that. Notice 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15. Peter makes this observation and this instruction. He says, always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. Now, folks, I have heard in my lifetime that passage be used as justification for defending Church of Christ doctrine. That's not what that passage says. That passage doesn't say give a defense to your church. It says give a defense to everyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. 1 Peter 3:15 tells us you tell your story when asked. You tell your story. You explain why you are a believer. Doesn't have anything to do with your church. Doesn't have anything to do with that. It's very personal. It's intimate. You're supposed. This is like being asked. If we stick with the major analogies that God uses of our relationship to Him, this is similar. This is comparable to someone asking me about my relationship with Sharon. This is like somebody asking me, give a defense for being married to her and loving her. It's the same thing. That's what Peter's reminding us of, is give a defense for the hope that is in you. Doesn't have anything to do with your church. Doesn't have anything to do with what is taught here on Sunday. That's not what it's about. It's about Christ. And so we need to recognize that. Already touched on this a little bit. Teach the Bible, not Church of Christ tradition. Don't argue with me that we don't have them. Trust me. If you don't believe that, if you've not run into it, I'll tell you some stories.
Oh, yeah.
But there are some unwritten catechisms out there. They don't necessarily have to be written on paper with ink. We cannot fall into that trap. That's not what people are interested in. Again, they are interested in relationship. Look, you and I even don't like the idea of trying to be converted to something, let alone somebody who is outside of the body. And so I'll return where we started. By this all people will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. The critical word is if, because he leaves that now to us. He's saying to his disciples, in this case his apostles specifically, but by extension to us. He's saying to his apostles, this is on you. I'm not going to force you to do it. I'm just telling you, if you do it, if you make that choice. And let me tell you something, that's a hard choice. I want you to notice, we don't have it up there on the screen, but if you back up in the text, He says, I want you to love one another the way that I have loved you. That's high. That's a high standard. That is really that agape, unconditional idea. That I'm going to love you whether you like it or not. I'm going to love you even if I don't like what you're doing. I'm going to love you even if there's nothing in return. I'm going to love you even if you're trying to damage our relationship. Because you have value, because you are one of God's creation. You are God's creation. And because Jesus is God, and He was at the creation, He created man. He recognizes this is what mankind desires. This is what we want. Look, we everyone understand this. When we think about every funeral we've gone to, you know the old adage that nobody ever put on their tombstone, I wish I'd spent more time at work. Why? Because when it comes down to our final breaths, what do we really want? What are we really thinking about? What are we really concerned about? As I get older, I was a very ambitious young man. But as I get older, I find that I melt in the presence of my 18-month-old granddaughter. You know, that the steely-eyed killer kind of melts down into his boots, and there is an 18-month-old that has me wrapped around her finger. And if she wants an ice cream sandwich for breakfast, that's what she's getting. Why? Because relationships count. Yeah, Grandma might not. But if you ain't there, I'll give it to her. Relationships count. People need them. They want them. They desire them. And that's what Jesus is offering them in John 13. He's reminding His disciples, what we've got is gold. What we got is fulfilling. It's life. It brings meaning to your life. Your job, like we talked about last night in Ecclesiastes, your job won't. It might give you meaning while you're here, but this gives you meaning to your life, that you loved people and that you brought people to Christ and that Christ could love them and they could love Jesus. Thanks so much for your kind attention.